This is Wyatt Cenac, and you're listening to The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
Yes, Wyatt's here, and you're with us on The Takeaway for April 11th. First up, though, tax service companies like H&R Block and TurboTax want you to use their services, and they're successfully lobbying Congress to do just that.
If you keep taxes complicated, if you keep more red tape around how taxes work, people will pay tax preparers to help them file their taxes.
We'll talk about what this Taxpayer First Act would mean for you and whether it's really putting taxpayers first. Also on the show, why Texans seem to have an outsized role in federal politics.
It's a lot easier to rise to the top in a small state with 2 or 3 million people. If you can get to the top in Texas, that means you're the best of the best.
And yes, comedian Wyatt Cenac will talk to me about the new season of his HBO show, which is a deep dive into the education system. All right, let's get to it.
Here's what I want to do. I want to simplify the tax code. I want to cut taxes.
President Donald Trump campaigned on simplifying the tax code, and here he is saying just that in 2015 with Sean Hannity.
I want to simplify the tax code. I want to make it great for the middle class. The middle class is being killed. I want to put H&R Block, it's an ambition of mine, to put H&R Block out of business.
But if the president signs the Taxpayer First Act, it could do just the opposite. Have you heard about this bill? With a little over a week away from tax day, Congress is set to pass this new legislation that could limit the options for American taxpayers in the future. One provision that's raising questions is that it would make it illegal for the IRS to offer a free e-filing service for taxpayers. On Tuesday, the Taxpayer First Act passed the House of Representatives with bipartisan support.
I'd like to thank my friends and my dear friend from Georgia, Congressman Lewis, and also Mike Kelly, for their work on this legislation, for supporting the modernization of the IRS and protecting innocent Americans from IRS abuse.
GOP Georgia Representative Doug Collins there. And now the bill heads to the Senate. You might already use an e-filing service like TurboTax or H&R Block, and you probably pay for that because filing your taxes is not easy.
I used TurboTax. It took me about 6 hours.
I filed my taxes myself, and it wasn't easy.
The tax laws were so complicated, I had to hire somebody.
Happy to pay for an accountant to do my taxes.
At one point, I made an error.
We use an accountant because clergy taxes are extremely difficult.
We decided we'd invest in the self-employed version of TurboTax every year, and we've never looked back.
And you told us those services aren't cheap.
I just mail them to my guy in Kansas City. Pay him $100.
$600.
$125.
$200.
$495 a year.
$1,000.
Hannah Leventova is a reporter for Mother Jones, and she's been covering changes to tax law. Hannah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the Taxpayer First Act, is it really taxpayers first?
So that is up for debate right now. There is one provision in this bill that has gotten a lot of attention over the last few days that would essentially prohibit the IRS, the tax collection agency, from creating its own free online system of tax filing. And it's a provision that the tax preparation industry, so companies like H&R Block or Intuit, which own TurboTax, that's a change that they have pushed for many years. The reason I say that it's up for debate whether this is a Taxpayer First Act is because it's not like the IRS currently has a free government-run system for us to file our taxes already. It's not getting rid of something that exists. It's simply preventing it from happening permanently. That being said, there are a lot of other provisions in the bill that both Republicans and Democrats see as positive, which is why this bill sailed through the House just a couple of days ago and is expected to pass the Senate as well. So there's a lot of debate about that question right now.
I mean, what's interesting to me here is, A, that there is no current, as you mentioned, the IRS does not have a system in place, first of all. And second of all, how these private companies have essentially lobbied the federal government to get this across. What would it do for them? How would TurboTax and H&R Block benefit from this?
So currently, they are part of basically a coalition of big tax prep companies that have an agreement with the IRS that says, okay, IRS, you won't create your own filing system for taxes, but we, this coalition of tax prep companies, will offer a free file option to families that are below a certain income threshold. So ostensibly, this kind of free file option still exists. The reality is that by stopping or pushing the government to not create a free file system, you know, TurboTax, H&R Block, they essentially get more customers, because if you keep taxes complicated, if you keep more red tape around how taxes work, people will pay tax preparers to help them file their taxes.
And how long has the tax prep business been involved in lobbying Congress? I mean, is this something, because the timing seems quite curious. We're a week away from tax day and this comes out.
So on this particular question of preventing the IRS from creating its own free file system, the tax prep industry has been lobbying Congress on this for a long time, and they've spent millions of dollars doing it. So it's not, this is not the first year that this has happened. They, just in the last year alone, in 2018, H&R Block and Intuit, which owns TurboTax, spent over $6 million on lobbying on various issues, not just this. But, you know, the thing that they have continued to lobby for over years has been kind of maintaining this agreement that already exists between the IRS and tax prep companies, which I mentioned. So they've spent money kind of maintaining the status quo as various proposals have popped up to say, hey, maybe the IRS could create a free file system. So, for example, Elizabeth Warren has repeatedly filed legislation proposing that the government create its own free file system. That legislation has never passed. So this is not the first year that this question has arisen or that tax prep companies have lobbied Congress.
Now, to make it a little more complicated, there is something else called the Free File Alliance. What is that?
So the Free File Alliance is a coalition of big tax prep companies that offers a privately run, industry run, free file option for families below a certain threshold. So right now, the IRS and this Free File Alliance, this coalition of tax prep companies, have what's called a memorandum of understanding. And every few years, they renegotiate this memorandum, which essentially says, we, the IRS, we won't create our own free file system, but you, tax prep companies, pledge to continue running this Free File Alliance and offering a free file option to families that are below a certain income threshold. And the Free File Alliance currently says that about 70% of Americans are actually eligible for their free file option, so millions and millions and millions of people. But data has shown that only somewhere in the ballpark of 2 to 3% of Americans who are eligible to file for free actually do it. So this option is being really, really underutilized, and a lot of people are paying money to file taxes that don't need to be paying that money.
You said 70% of taxpayers are eligible for these services, but only 3% use them. Is that because they don't know? They haven't been advertised? Like, what is that's a huge gap.
It is a huge gap. So there has been some great reporting, namely from ProPublica on this, showing that the Free File Alliance, critics will say that they underpromote their free file option, or that they essentially use it to market some of their paid products. So that's one possibility as to why there's this huge gap that people just don't know. And the argument from tax experts who want an IRS-run system is, well, hey, most people know the IRS. If the IRS ran a free option, if it was just straight government-run and not a third party, well, presumably more people would know and they would save money filing their taxes.
Mm. Now, what about the issue here of taxes in general? I mean, I think about the tax code, and you're someone that's seeped in it. I don't know much about taxes. If somebody gave me a traditional form and said, here, fill them out, I would not really have enough to be able to do that on my own. Are Americans educated enough about these issues in general?
You know, taxes are wonky. They just are. And I think that's just true across the board. Taxes are complicated. Money is complicated. But a lot of other countries, dozens of other countries, many in Europe, have created government-run free file systems, which essentially is when the government tax agency, whatever it is, fills out your return for you. Because they, for most people with fairly uncomplicated finances, they kind of already have all the information they need. So in the UK, in Germany, in many European countries, this is the norm. And so filing taxes is free and it's really fast. So the onus isn't necessarily on taxpayers to know the ins and outs of the tax code. The tax code is really complicated, but there are a lot of countries where the government has tried to streamline this process as much as possible to make it simple for their constituents.
We've been talking a lot about this particular provision with private tax prep companies, but what else does the bill do? Is there anything else that's positive for taxpayers?
So, yes, and that is why there was a lot of Democratic support for this bill when it passed the House. So one of the things that it does is that it would, if passed, it would stop private debt collectors from going after, from calling low-income taxpayers to go after their uncollected taxes or liabilities and things like that. It also offers millions of dollars in program assistance for low-income taxpayers, creates some new processes around fraud prevention and cybersecurity at the IRS. So there's a lot of other meaty stuff in this bill that a lot of Democrats have said they want to support and that this is their opportunity to get through. So when this was on the House floor a couple of days ago, you know, several new congressmen, so Katie Hill, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, spoke up about this, gave speeches and said, you know, we oppose the free filing provision. We oppose that. But at the same time, we're going to still support this bill because there's so much other good stuff in it.
And in terms of what happens next with the legislation, I mean, it sounds like it's pretty likely, given the bipartisan support, to pass.
So now this bill heads to the Senate, and a couple of days ago, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Chuck Grassley, said that he was considering kind of avoiding the process of going through the Senate Finance Committee completely and just trying to get it to the floor faster, because a couple of days ago, before a lot of coverage of this provision, this was a fairly uncontroversial bill. It passed the House on a voice vote, which is a process that's typically used for kind of uncontroversial pieces of legislation. Now that there's been so much coverage of this free file option, I don't know if that's still going to happen, but it's headed to the Senate next and probably to the Senate Finance Committee for debate.
Hannah Leventova is a reporter for Mother Jones. Hannah, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we reached out to the White House to see if President Trump plans to sign this bill into law should it pass the Senate, but they did not provide us with a comment. Texas officials are on deadline. Today, they had to hand over documents to a congressional committee investigating whether the state tried to suppress immigrant votes. In January, the Texas State Department said that 100,000 people on its voter rolls might not be citizens. The state gave people on that list 30 days to prove that they were citizens, or else they would be purged from the voter rolls. But in February, a federal judge blocked the State Department from removing names, calling the state's actions, quote, ham-handed and threatening. Allie Morris is a reporter for the San Antonio Express News, and she's been following the story closely. Allie, thanks for being with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So can you walk us through briefly what these lawsuits and the congressional investigation have gone?
Basically, what happened started in January when, as you mentioned, the Secretary of State flagged, you know, nearly 100,000 people as potential non-citizens on the voter rolls. Immediately, Republicans ran with that number, some people tweeting out that it showed potential voter fraud in Texas. But then pretty quickly, within days, county elections officials here found huge flaws with the list and quickly cleared at least 20,000 names from the list without even doing a further vetting. And so now with this lawsuit, the judge obviously blocked this purge. And now both sides are in settlement talks, which we understand might be resolved as early as the end of this month, which would so far basically call on the state to scrap this effort and start over. And then in the meantime, we have Democrats in Congress launching this investigation into Texas and actually some other states too, looking at into what they call, you know, potentially suppressing votes in some of these states. And as you mentioned, the Secretary of State has until today to turn over some records. As far as we know, they are cooperating with that request. They obviously had to turn over documents as part of the lawsuit, so I assume much of that will be the same.
Allie, how did the state determine who would be flagged as a potential non-citizen here? What criteria did they use?
So what the state did is they looked at driver's license data and tried to identify people who had at one point showed up to a driver's license office and told officials there that they weren't a citizen. Now, the problem is that the state looked at data going back as far as 20 years. And what critics were quick to point out is that comparing this information to the state's voter rolls could flag people who went to a DMV, said they were a non-citizen, and then before they renewed their license years later, became naturalized. There's about 50,000 people in Texas who are naturalized citizens every year. So quite a number of those people were caught up in the list.
We have a State Department, a U.S. State Department statement, and I'd like to read you a part of it. It says, quote, "We are encouraged by the positive and constructive progress we've made with the plaintiffs, and we remain committed to our goal of maintaining accurate voter rolls while eliminating the impact of any list maintenance activity on eligible Texas voters." What do they mean when they say positive and constructive progress?
Obviously, a final settlement hasn't been reached in this case, but so far we understand that they're pretty close. And what that deal might look like is scrapping this method that they've used and moving forward, doing the same type of effort, but only looking at people who registered to vote and then went to a driver's license office and reported themselves as non-citizens. So not taking this risk of potentially flagging people who may be naturalized, which is what the federal judge said basically created a mess that intimidated some of these naturalized citizens.
Now, I just want to clarify here, was there anyone who was actually purged from the rolls?
No. So in fact, the judge basically halted the effort before that could take place. And a few counties actually sent out notice to voters on the list saying that they had to show proof of citizenship within 30 days or potentially be stricken from the voter rolls. However, before that time period was up, the judge called a halt to this effort. So as far as we know, no one was actually removed from the rolls as a result of this effort.
What is this investigation trying to attain that did not happen in the lawsuits?
I think what congressional Democrats are aiming at is trying to look at Texas and some other states to see what efforts, what they claim might be efforts to suppress the vote. And, you know, Texas is a state that has continually faced lawsuits for some of the voting steps they have taken. You know, Republicans here continually say that they want to ensure elections where, you know, no non-citizens are potentially voting, and they want to kind of crack down on what they call voter fraud. The Democrats say, you know, there's been no evidence of any kind of widespread voter fraud. But still, the state has passed some pretty strict voter ID laws that were subject to litigation, and also the state's political maps where they've drawn congressional districts and also legislative districts have been subject to the same litigation and claims of potential suppression.
Texas Secretary of State David Whitley told the Texas Monthly, quote, "We will fully comply. We have absolutely nothing to hide," and added that they would turn over any documentation that they were asked to turn over. Have they?
They have. I spoke with someone at the office yesterday, and they said they plan to send some materials to congressional investigators, obviously as part of the lawsuit. They had to turn over reams of data. But most of that has been under seal. So when reporters have been trying to get information such as the names on this list or potential emails or correspondence between, you know, agencies and political figures here, we haven't been able to get that. But once the lawsuit is settled, we're thinking that those documents might become more publicly available.
Allie Morris is a reporter for the San Antonio Express News. Allie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Now we're going to take a wider angle look at the outsized impact Texas voters have on the rest of the country. And to do that, we're going to talk to Mark Jones, a fellow in political science at Rice University's Baker Institute. Mark, thanks for being with us.
No, thanks for having me on the show.
We hear a lot about states like Florida, but tell us a little bit about the political influence that Texas has on the rest of the country.
Well, first and foremost, we're the second most populous state in the country, which means we have 36 members of the U.S. House, which is the second largest delegation after California. We also are the one true red state among the major states. California's blue, New York is blue, Florida is purple. We're the one red state. And so we're sort of a keystone for Republican politics across the country. If Texas falls for Republicans or falters, then nationally, they're pretty much out of luck.
Now, we currently have a New Yorker in the White House, but we know Texans are continuing to strike chords across the country. We're thinking about politicians like George W. Bush, Rick Perry, Ted Cruz, and Beto O'Rourke, and of course, Julian Castro. What does that tell us about? Is there something in the water?
Well, I think there's something in the water in the sense that we're a huge state. We have 20 media markets, 28 million people. It takes a really talented person and a hardworking person to rise to the top in a state like Texas. It's a lot easier to rise to the top in a small state with 2 or 3 million people. If you can get to the top in Texas, that means you're the best of the best. And so we tend to see politicians that succeed here as in our proving ground, better able to have success in national politics than people from smaller states.
What about the shade? You mentioned that Texas is solidly red, but there were efforts a couple years ago to try and tilt that balance, or there have been efforts to tilt that balance a little more perhaps to the purple side of things. How are those efforts going?
Well, the first efforts back in 2014 with Battleground Texas failed dismally, with Governor Greg Abbott, the Republican governor, defeating his Democratic rival Wendy Davis by 20 points. Now, Democrats have been helped in recent years, in 2016 and particularly 2018, by the presence of Donald Trump in the White House. He's a millstone around Texas Republicans' necks, and he's dragging the party down, helping Democrats mobilize, as well as driving some independent and Republican voters away from the Republican Party and towards the Democratic Party, potentially turning Texas purple right now. But I think once Donald Trump leaves office in 2020, assuming that happens, Republicans will probably be able to gain back some of the ground that they've lost during the Trump administration.
So should we not make much out of the fact that in November, Beto O'Rourke came close to beating Ted Cruz?
Well, I think that was a warning sign for Texas Republicans. And I think what it means for the future depends on what the Republican Party does here in Texas. If it follows a path that's being proposed by people like George P. Bush, our land commissioner, or Greg Abbott, our governor, and trying to essentially steer a more centrist course, I think the Republican Party is still in pretty good shape to keep its majority into the next decade. On the other hand, if it follows the more polarizing politicians, such as our Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who is a big supporter of a bathroom bill to ban transgender bathroom use, then the Republican Party could very well be in trouble during the next decade, even if Donald Trump leaves office. So I think right now the ball is in the court of the Republican Party in Texas, and depending on how it behaves over the next few years, Texas could either turn purple or it could stay red.
Mark Jones is a political science fellow at Rice University's Baker Institute. Mark, thanks for coming on The Takeaway.
Oh, thank you.
Comedian Wyatt Cenac is probably best known for his work as a correspondent on The Daily Show.
We're joined by our senior racist correspondent, Wyatt Cenac.
It's racialist, senior racialist correspondent. Come on, dude, is that beard affecting your ability to read?
And today, he hosts his own show, Problem Areas, on HBO. But long before he made it to television, Wyatt was a high school student in Dallas, Texas, at a private school where most of the kids didn't look like him.
I remember at one point, one of my counselors, my sophomore year,
I think I was averaging kind of somewhere between like a low B and a C. And he said, hey, that's good. You're the smartest of the black kids. And coming out of that educational experience, I definitely felt like, okay, I lacked a lot as far as like the social growth that I would have liked from an education.
In this season of Problem Areas, why it's focusing on education across the United States, from teacher strikes to school safety. And when I sat down with him, he explained how his private school background shaped his perspective on the school privatization debate.
So often, the conversation that we're having right now with things like school choice, we demonize charter schools. And I understand why people feel like they want to create charter schools. They feel failed by the public school system. And so at least in their inception, that was the idea behind charter schools. It's now become something that you have seen corporate money get really involved in, and capitalism has perhaps perverted what that original intent was. What's a shame is that someone feels failed by the public schools and we can't just fix the public schools.
And we're seeing that play out also with the educators themselves, right? Where on the show, we've covered the teacher strikes across the country. We know you, for the first episode of the show, you guys went down to West Virginia, where essentially the teacher strikes were, you know, started. What was the message that you heard from teachers in West Virginia, teachers that you've interviewed, about their striking?
I think one of the biggest ones is respect and just what feels like a lack of respect for the craft that is teaching.
At least part of the solution needs to be more funding. We need to fill the 700 teacher vacancies.
There's an element of it that I think people dismiss teachers, and so often teachers wind up being labeled as greedy for wanting a living wage.
The whole end game behind the pay raise is to fill those vacancies, is to make sure that we have the best quality education. It isn't so that I can buy a Disney Vacation Club. It's so that, you know, I don't have to say, well, there's been a sub in that position for 3 years because they can't get anybody in here. They won't take the pay.
You're talking about a group of individuals who actually, you know, perform a huge service. It's more than babysitting. And so I think it's getting people to sort of respect and appreciate that, right, they are being entrusted with a lot. And if we don't respect that as a profession, it's going to pay out in ways that we don't recognize, as far as low graduation rates. But those are people who now have to go into a workforce. And when we think about innovation, those are people who may not be leaders of innovation. And so recognizing the role that education plays in all that, and that teachers play in all that, and respecting that, that feels like one of the biggest things that from city to city I experienced from teachers.
We know also that our education system, as we've sort of talked about, is flawed in many ways, our public education system in particular. I'm a product of that system, so I will say it can be done, yeah. But it's very hard. And when you start looking at education by race in this country, there are some stark differences, and particularly in how black students and brown students are disciplined, et cetera. Are you planning on addressing those issues in this season?
Yes. For our second episode, the focus is looking at school safety and what this idea of school safety is, and the measures, the things that keep finding their ways into schools, things like scanners, things like police officers. What does that actually look like? What has that looked like for many black and brown students for decades? And what does it look like when you have the money to give those resources to schools, but don't necessarily have the money to give them STEM labs and give them arts programs?
How do you take a topic like this and inflect a little humor into it? Because that is sort of, I'm hoping and assuming, what you guys are going to attempt to do.
I think when you interact with people and you get their stories and you have their experiences, there is a humor that they bring to it. And so I think for me, my job is really just helping their stories feel both real and allowing the natural humor that's there to kind of come through.
The leaders of the strike were women, predominantly women.
Except for like one guy who really killed it with his posters. I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's... I'm used to mansplaining.
Ouch. But fair.
And then I get to go into the studio and do dumb, silly things because we can comment on clips of things, or I can just dress up in a weird costume for no real reason.
We should note there are no weird costumes today. That's pretty straightforward.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that.
I mean, unless you consider that a costume, I think it's pretty straightforward.
I don't consider it a costume. No, you could have very easily said right now, are you wearing a costume? Which would have told me that it would have told me how you see my fashion sense.
Pivoting for a second, you mentioned The Daily Show, and let's just say the landscape right now on late night television is so male and so white. When you were at The Daily Show, I know that there was a dispute that you had with Jon Stewart over being the only black writer at the time. And I want to ask you, how has that changed? Because we know black writers in writers' rooms on shows like The Daily Show, Saturday Night Live, or any show really, is rare. Have you seen change?
I want to say yes, but I also am kind of siloed off. Our studios are in Brooklyn, and we don't have much interaction with any of the other shows. But I think it's not just about the people in the writers' rooms. It's also about looking at executives and how are we making sure that those decision makers, the ones who are the ones who can greenlight a show, that there is that diversity and inclusion on that level as well. That's where you're going to see the most change, and the most thoughtful change is if all your executives are just white guys, there may be 100 shows that are being pitched by people of color. What they're choosing may not be the thing that resonates with an audience of color or with their best interests in mind. They're coming from their own perspective and their own bias. And that may be, oh, we want a show that is specifically this thing. And that thing to people of color might feel stereotypical. It might feel like it is a caricature. And so while it's nice to see more people of color finding their ways into writers' rooms, finding their ways behind the camera, we still have to look at the decision makers.
Wyatt Cenac is the host of Wyatt Cenac's Problem Areas on HBO. Thank you, Wyatt.
Thank you.
Okay, everyone, that's our show for today. And that's it for me this week in the host chair. However, I'll be hanging out tomorrow on Politics with Amy Walter, and my friend Amy and I are going to talk about reparations and how the candidates for 2020 are handling this issue. You can check that out tomorrow or anytime on the Politics with Amy Walter podcast. And make sure you check out the Daily Takeaway podcast, too. We appreciate you for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Can Cory Booker win the White House with this message?
We need a revival of civic grace. Yes, we need a more compassionate empathy. We need leaders that are not going to pit us against each other. Because when I travel this country, I find so much common pain.
My interview with Senator Booker next time on The Takeaways, Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRI.